Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Paul Olson, and he will be doing a session entitled The Gospel in Secular Literature. So let's listen in on Paul.
Y'all read at one time or other, either had it read to you or you read it to somebody else, you know, that wonderful little poem, Hi Diddle Diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon, right? Little dog laughed, keep going.
The seeds have just started in the future and the cow jumped over the
moon. We have it memorized. Okay, now we're going to go to Paradise Lost. You ready? You don't have that one. Well, I would submit to you that Paradise Lost speaks lots of deep truths about the lordship of God, the freedom giving of Jesus. I mean, Paradise Lost is that great English poem by John Milton that's longer than, I mean, most English majors take it as a course separately. You take Paradise Lost. But you don't know that one, but you knew Hi Diddle Diddle, the Cat and the Fiddle. Do you kind of walk around Holden, you guys, saying that every now and then? Hi Diddle Diddle, the Cat and the Fiddle. Anybody do that?
Yeah.
Stupid question. Not yet. Stick to the guy with stinky feet and you're gonna. It's the ugly feet, not stinky. That's right. So we have some criteria, and what I thought I would do for a while, and we'll get together and just kind of share our ideas collectively on the process of deciding what's good literature and what's not so good. And the process of what I believe as a literature teacher is that there has to be gospel truths, because the gospel is true. And because we're looking for deep truths in literature, there has to be gospel truths in literature before it's going to get to us. And that's why you don't wander around Holden Village saying, Hi Diddle Diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon. I'd like to take that, just for about 60 seconds, a little bit further. Think with me, what's the first line? Hey Diddle Diddle. And anybody have an idea what that means? Hey. Thank you, I didn't even want to hear it. You had one? Okay. That's called teacher intimidation. Well, I did have one, but not. No one dare say that. Go ahead if you had one. I am. Actually. Great teaching right here. No, just intimidate. Nobody will talk. Actually, if we knew the satirical connections to government about that poem, we would find a meaning in Hey Diddle Diddle. That's how that thing originally got composed. And I know that only because I've been an English teacher a long time, but I don't know what it is. I just know that it's true. But we don't have that anymore. All we have is Hey Diddle Diddle, and when we read that to our kids or had it read to us, we didn't have any of this satirical governmental bashing stuff. We just had Hey Diddle Diddle. What's the next line?
The cat.
Okay, so we've got this cat, and he's got a fiddle. No? Okay. Next line. My artistry is being stretched here now. We got the moon and we got this cow. Like I said, it's being stretched. Okay, next line.
Little dog laughed.
Get the little dog with big droopy ears. And he's smiling. That's a smile and it's a dog. Little dog laughed to see. Next line. Those are, admittedly, weak representations of the images of that silly poem. And they collectively don't mean anything to us. So, obviously, that poem doesn't get to us. We don't walk around Holden Village saying it. It survives because it's got a wonderful rhythm. Hey, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle, because the images are fun, because the kids say when they're two, read it again, but when they're four, they might say read it again, but when they're six, they're not going to say that. When they're 16, they're surely not going to say that. They're looking for something else. We're looking. We all are. We're looking for some kind of deep truths. Yet I would submit, as lots of us read, we sometimes get hung up on, not on this simple level, but we get hung up on these specific images and try to find them to say something, try to have them say something to us when in fact there's a lot more there than just a spoon. There's just a dish. None of these separate little representations mean anything. And because we don't know what their, again, their satirical importance was, we don't know what they mean collectively either. Well, that's one example only, just to get us into a discussion here, of the way that sometimes we look at things, even though we don't know we're looking at them that way. I'll give you a better example. I use this one to set us up. The better example is, since we did it last night, it was great timing. We did it last night at Vespers. We had the creation story read to us in a fun, meaningful way, you know, and everybody did it. We wanted to do it again. And God said, I thought, man, you can't memorize your lines past one night. Zing! <Yeah. laughs> Anybody else have a line? Okay, well, that reminds you of that whole story. And I've asked some questions about that story. And I'll just remind you that you probably already know this, but I'll just so we're all on the same page. That story has two accounts in the first two chapters of Genesis. You know that. And one account lists a whole lot of things that go on, and then God created this, this, and this, and the other account lists a whole lot of other things. And the accounts differ, don't they? Can you think of any of the differences?
Creation of man and woman.
Yeah, the creation of man and woman. And so in one of them, how does it go? And then we'll take a vote on women, which boys, or which version you like the best. The better. Yeah. What's the one version? The first?
The one you used last night.
Has anybody read James Weldon Johnson's poem, The Creation? Where did I just see it? Oh, it was in the resource room. Anyway, that's where God does that out of dust and stuff. Okay, so he creates both of them at the same time in that one, right? That's what we talked about last night. What are the versions that in the Genesis story, though?
7 days.
7 days.
Yep.
And at the end?
He creates man.
He creates man.
It's really Adam.
And don't get cocky, because you weren't even in the picture. He creates man, and then how does woman get in there? Takes our rib out, and it's really kind of a, what?
After.
A kind of an afterthought. I'm going to try to see if this guy can get along with the cows and the fish. And he can't, so give him a woman. I'm obviously pushing, and that didn't work either, I should say. That didn't work either. What's next?
That was the crown.
Trucks. That was the crown, yeah. Then the next version comes along, and what happens? About man and...
Male and female, he created them in his own image.
Yeah, listen to the quote. Great. I'm going to call on you again. Man, and male and female, he created them at the same time. Now, we'll vote. Which version do you like better? Women. One, the woman is out of the... Never mind, you know. Okay. There's some other differences, too. And they are... What else? Without going into the story, because I want to move on into what I've called secular literature. Okay, there's probably an argument that that's kind of secular literature too. But any other differences you can think of? If you haven't just read it, you wouldn't know. The very first thing created in the first, you know, in the first couple of verses is, remember?
Light.
And then, ironically enough, in that story, what comes along later that's related to light?
The sun.
So, where the heck did the light come from? I'll read it to you. It's the 4B verse. You probably haven't read this. It's something about ever ready. Have you heard that? So where does this light come from? There's a wonderful line in The Man of La Mancha when Don Quixote is talking to his sidekick. And his sidekick says to him, I want the facts, I want the truth, I gotta have it all. And Don Quixote turns to him and says, facts are the greatest enemy of truth. And I've written that up on the board here to suggest, and then I'll apply that concept to this story of Genesis. It's ironic, or it's interesting, I should say, that in our country, and I can name some of the states, I know that Maine has, I know that Louisiana has, I know that California has, I know that North Carolina has, South Carolina, Texas, have taken our understanding of the creation story to court. This is how it must be read. And you know, then the battle of evolution and creationism and all that stuff gets caught up in that. Well, what they're taking to court are the facts. And the facts are left in that story by somebody who edited this thing and put these two stories together. They didn't sort out those differences, did they? We have two stories, pick them, about how a woman was created. We have two stories, pick them, about when if plants were first, or if fish were first, or if, you know, beasts of the land and birds, and all over the plants, animals, you get the point. And they're all different. The order in version one and version two is different. So what are we taking to court here?
Facts.
We're taking facts to court. And listen to Don Quixote. It's a wonderful line. If you were my students at Augustana, I would say, you've heard me say this, some of you, write it on your forehead so when you brush your teeth in the morning, it's there in the mirror. That is, facts are the enemy of truth. Most of us, or we ought too often, look for facts and we fail to kind of step back. We're going to do that right now, and then I'm going to get into some stuff that is clearly secular literature. Let's step back and never mind the facts. He created them, male and female, he created them, or the rib story. Never mind those facts. What are some truths about those two stories that somebody left in there deliberately not resolving the contradictions? Yes?
That God, in his power, created the world.
So for sure, God is creator. And don't get me hung up on the details. I mean, because they're asking us not to get hung up on the details, because the details are different. Keep going. Some other truths. Some wonderful... Well, keep going.
It was very good.
Yeah, this is good. The creation.
Really good.
Okay, I got it. Let's pass the Bibles out. We're going to write that over in all those. Really good. Just scratch it. Okay, what else do we know?
Man was created in God's image.
Okay, so humans, we'll say, in God's image. Good?
The whole thing is very intentional.
It's intentional.
It's an accident.
I am created by God. It's kind of neat to know, isn't it? I was created before you. I don't really care. I was, you were, we... It's intentional. And, well, keep going.
There was order.
Huh?
There was order.
There's order. And, I'm going to push you a little bit on that one. Order. O-R, yeah. Jeez. Order comes from what?
Chaos.
Chaos.
Wow. Let's go back and then we'll move on to something else, because I know you get this. Where does light come from? It comes from the darkness. I would submit there ain't nobody else that can do that. Right? I'm using that
thing. I'd say light is.
Huh?
Light is.
Light is.
Period.
Period. And light comes out of the darkness. Now, let's see if the writers, if we're going to be readers of literature, and let's pretend we've got the secular story, even though it's about creation, and we've got all these facts, and we're going to go along with Don Quixote and say, facts are the enemy of truth. I don't want to take, because if we're taken to court the facts, we're looking for history, we're looking for science. And listen to Quixote. It's the enemy of truth. And I'm a lot more concerned with, hey, I want you to know that these birds were created before these fish, and by golly, I'm taking it to court, don't give me any of this geological survey stuff. This is what it is. And I want science. And if Don Quixote is right, and it's the enemy of truth, how is it the enemy of truth? What am I missing if I'm paying attention to the, and I have to have these facts, and I have to have them verified and all that?
It draws away from the essential part of the story.
Perfect words. You get an A today. Essential. The essentials of the story, and that's when we step back. I'll give you a little challenge. From now on, when you go to church and you hear the lesson, go back home and read the context of that lesson. Read around the whole book. You know, if it's Matthew 7:27, go back home and read Matthew. Read the whole thing in an hour, can you? Just do it and see what the whole story is, and then that little story in the middle. It's meaningful, it makes sense, but it's different in the context of the whole thing. Well, all of these facts that we just talked about are different in these in this context. The last thing to suggest about this, I can't imagine, because you guys, you gave me the idea. We didn't like Hi Diddle Diddle because it didn't touch our soul. It didn't make us ask or wonder about deep truths or clarify any deep truths. Is it a deep truth that you care about that fish were created before birds, whatever the order is? I mean, who cares, really? But what do you care about? What do you think these writers, and I'm going to call them an editor, that put the two stories together?
Well, I was going to make a comment about the two stories, too, which I think answers your question. The first creation story doesn't focus on humans, it focuses on the whole process of creation. The humans are just a tiny part of that. The second version focuses on the humans a lot more than the creation. So there's actually those two stories balance each other. And I think what that tells us is that no, we better not get too anthropocentric because we are part of a larger order, and yeah. We have to think about then that special relationship we have to not only to God but then to the order of creation, I won't say more.
Yeah, that's a great point, and it doesn't contradict our idea. However, that we have deliberate contradictions in the story about the order of creation. And they're there. And you highlight an important point of stepping back and looking at those stories collectively, and this is one of the themes that, you know, as you just spelled out. If a writer or a storyteller is going to give us deep truths, and we miss those because we get hung up on the facts, look what we've missed. And then let's see if a writer wants to say something about the human condition, the deep truths of the human condition. And I'm going to argue gospel truths of the human condition. One of those gospel truths is, you wrote it up here, I wrote, and you said I wrote it up here, that God can create light out of darkness. Have we ever grieved? And where's the light? Do you think we're ever going to come back to the light again? That God can create order out of chaos. What am I going to do next year? I'm graduating from college and I don't even have a job. I experience that with kids every year. It's a chaotic wilderness experience. What am I going to do next year? And out of that chaos, each of us, don't we? We can all account for our own chaotic experiences in life. I'm suggesting to you that I think the writer has some truths in mind that do touch us. And if they didn't touch us, I can't imagine how this story would last so long. If this was supposed to be, well, everybody with me? So we want to really work at getting the deep truths, I like that phrase, the deep truths out of these stories. I like this phrase. We want to get the essentials out of that story. Can you think of examples in your life, in your own reading, where you've had to kind of struggle with struggle with this notion of step back. Let's get a sense of all this. I'll give you some examples to get you started. Jesus made some statements. One of them was, you know, servants obey your masters, that slaveholders pulled out of context and made it an argument for slavery. That's been an argument for apartheid in South Africa for, you know, until 1990. Things like that, where we need to kind of step back and say, well, what do we think Jesus meant by that? And in the context of his ministry, that couldn't possibly be it, could it? I mean, we all know that. That can't possibly mean, hey, I'm condoning slavery here, and I think it's a good thing. There's nothing in his ministry, in his whole, the bigger context, the truths, the thematic step. Other things like that. And I'm not looking at the Bible now. You can't, but anything you can think of. Where you read and stepped back and said, this is what it tells me.
I took a constitutional law class, and it's filled with many, many
different little aspects of facts and things, but and I found that it's easy to get overwhelmed with the little interesting facts, but there was a bigger, larger message.
Yeah. Of what the, and the message is, has things to do with deep truths about what?
The legal system and our society and
yeah.
values and stuff. And
values and freedom and autonomy and independence and
yeah.
Good. Good. Anybody else? Let me give you an example from a story. And I like to pick this one because catching a rye. You know, I've got in South Dakota, they burned it. And lots of libraries got rid of it. And there's some goddammits and you know things in here that would make my father say, don't read that book, Paul. He's not that way anymore. But in secular literature, and this is a direct reference to Jesus, so we say, well, it's easy to see. There's something spiritual, something gospel in this. I'm going to say it's more than the obvious. And you see what you get out of this. You know, Holden Caulfield is the hero, the protagonist of Catcher in the Rye, and he's a bit of a squirrel. Yeah. I mean, he kind of goes against the grain in most everything. And he wears this wonderful hat tipped backwards. It's a hunter, and he looks stupid most of the time, and he quits school, and he gets kicked out of school. And he's pretty much a rebel. And in this paragraph, he's telling about an experience he had with a guy down the hall. Finally, though, I got undressed and got in bed. I felt like praying or something when I was in bed, but I couldn't do it. I can't always pray when I feel like it. In the first place, I'm sort of an atheist. I like Jesus and all. Just sort of an atheist. I'm sort of an atheist. I like Jesus and all, but I don't care too much for most of the other stuff in the Bible. Take the disciples, for instance. This is a great little line here. They annoy the hell out of me, if you want to know the truth. They were all right after Jesus was dead and all, but while he was alive, they were about as much use to him as a hole in the head. All they did was keep letting him down. I like almost anybody in the Bible better than the disciples. If you want to know the truth, the guy I like best in the Bible, next to Jesus, was that lunatic and all that lived in the tombs and kept cutting himself with stones. I like him 10 times as much as the disciples, the poor bastard. I used to get in quite a few arguments about this when I was at the Wooten School with this boy who lived down the corridor, Arthur Childs. And if you remember this book, he's always got these names and they're all crazy. And old Childs was a Quaker and all, and he read the Bible all the time. He was a very nice kid, and I liked him, but I could never see eye to eye with him on a lot of stuff in the Bible, especially the disciples. He kept telling me if I didn't like the disciples, then I didn't like Jesus and all. He said that because Jesus picked the disciples. And because Jesus picked the disciples, you were supposed to like them. Everybody with me? Therefore, no? Okay. But listen to Holden Caulfield's comeback. I said, I knew he picked them. But did he pick them at random? It's a wonderful, okay, now that's an episode where we can clearly see some connections, but we're going to step back from that. What's there? What? Just in that episode, we don't have to have read the book, just in that episode, stepping back and trying to say, well, I know what he said about disciples, and I know he picked them at random, and, you know, what's the truth about, you know, that's fiction, this is a novel. And of course we know that novels tell great truths, important truths. You know, in a way that, for some people, depending how we look at it, the creation story is a piece of fiction. But it tells wonderful truths about the relationship. Okay, you got something?
Yeah. Well, he keeps talking about, I don't like any of these characters. And that's kind of like how we are about always wanting to feel good. You know, we're going to read things and do things and so on that's going to make us feel good. And we like to be with people that make us feel good.
Yeah.
So religion is supposed to be a feel-good kind of thing. And since he doesn't feel good about it, well.
Okay, we're good. You guys are way past me already here. So one of the things is a truth in this that makes sense. Religion is not a feel-good deal. Put it crudely. Yeah, it isn't the purpose of it, right? You always feel good.
It kind of reminds me too of my, you know, of our ambiguity with our faith, with the church, and our relationship to God.
I'm sort of an atheist. Well, you know, and I suspect if we would be honest, we've all been atheists. We've wandered in there. I mean, is there one of us that says, never for a second have I doubted? I mean, that's not part of the human condition. And in fact, I'll read another one here, where doubt is not antithetical to faith, it's an integral part of faith. And so we have to be honest and say that ambiguity, good.
And Christ chose people who are far from perfect to be his disciples.
Yeah, so disciples are imperfect. Maybe I could be a disciple. I didn't think I could stack up for a while, but it took me a while.
Well, he's, you know, the character is trying to deal with the conventional wisdom, you know, of his time. We, you know, kids, especially at a certain point, are presented all these things as, quote, truths. But the, you know, quote, conventional wisdom is often, you know, dead, you know, lifeless stuff that has to have new things breathed into it, you know, through experience.
So, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Belief is unconventional? Is belief what this kid has? I know he picked him, but he picked him at random.
It seems like he associates disagreeing with God to equaling, therefore there can't be a God if he disagrees with him, or that's not permissible within that relationship.
For the other kid, for Childs, you mean?
No, for himself, he disagrees with God, Jesus' choices, and therefore he really can't be God if they have a disagreement on what was a good choice.
For which character? I'm not quite with you yet. Okay.
No.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. Good. Okay.
For myself, I find this, I can relate to the disciples because I see imperfections and mistakes that I made in the sense that I've done, that the shortcomings I've had, I can relate to the disciples. Evidently for him, he feels that he's living a perfect life and he can't understand why the disciples are messing up. So, and he thinks that, that's what I would say.
Yeah, okay.
I think
okay.
The black and white stuff is that Childs has. You know, Jesus picked him, and so you gotta like him. And he's saying it's not black and white.
Yeah. And faith isn't. This is about Christianity. This is the gospel. Jesus picked him, and it ain't black and white.
I guess what it means to me is that so many times we don't even question something that's in the Bible as Jesus picking the disciples and how he picked them. And he really does kind of come at the truth. He picked them randomly. And adults tell kids these things, and that they're sort of shrouded in a holiness or mystery or something. And he's saying he's kind of bearing the whole thing. That's not really true.
Yes,
explosive.
I want to come back after with a comment about that. You got me on an idea.
I think there might be a critique of pietism there, because really what Caulfield is responding to is not the truth, but a kind of pietistic version of truth where perfection is expected out of believers.
Yeah.
And then he sees the disciples and they're not perfect.
Yes.
And so he's a little bit misguided in saying he doesn't believe in God. What he doesn't believe in is pietism, the way religion gets conveyed.
And so I've written up here, if you can't read it, but faith is not equal to pietism. It's not equal to morality. I mean, in Jesus, the Gospels tell us, remember that everybody knows the story that Jesus, the rich guy goes up to Jesus and says, what do I have to do to be saved? And Jesus says, obey all the commandments. And the guy says, I have. Well, Jesus says, sorry, that ain't enough. You mean, what else is there? I've been moral. I have been pious. No, you got to sell all you have. And the man went away very sad because he was very rich. You know the story. I mean, okay. Then these two, I just want to ask you this question. And let your imagination go. And here's Jesus picking the disciples. And I just thought of how often college students, I mean, you remember your days there, and you maybe know kids and grandkids that have been there. There's incredible pressure on college kids to achieve. Geez, I got to get an A in this class, I got to get into med school. I got to, you know, it's there all the time, and it's a rare bird who just kind of lets it kind of flit away and not really worry about it. And Jesus walks up to this college student and says, "What's your grade point? That ain't good enough." I mean, that wouldn't happen, would it? He picked him at random. "Are you straight or gay?" Whoa, Lutheran Church is struggling with that, and all mainline churches are. And, I mean, Holden Caulfield doesn't have the truth about how that went. We're not talking about history. But what a concept. And you've put all those down there. Jesus picked him at random. What's the power in this story, then, in this little episode of fiction, in this crazy burned book at one time? Look at the truths, the deep truths you've picked up, the gospel truths that you've picked up. Yes?
Jesus can pick me because I'm a sinner.
Yeah, Jesus can pick me. And straight or gay, Democrat, I can't, it's hard for me to push that one. Democrat or Republican, what's your grade point? How fast do you run? I coach too. And I can't tell you how many kids think at first, they get to know our program, at first that their worth is contingent upon how fast they run or how far they throw something. And, you know, I'm not very good at it. Well, that's great reading, yes.
Maybe, too, it also reflects that Jesus' humanness in that he, like all of us, picked friends or other people for very human reasons.
Yeah. Good. Yep.
And maybe that's one of the things that's very difficult for us to understand, because we tend to forget the humanness of Christ. We stress the more holy parts of him, but he was also very human, and maybe he made mistakes too.
Obviously he made a mistake with Judas. It's in the plan, he had to have it. Okay, well, do you see what you've just done? Just a small episode. Now, that kind of contradicts, and I thought about this, that contradicts what I just said about stepping back, and you have to see an episode in the context of the whole book. And so we can legitimately, we're not going to deal with this in here tonight, but we can legitimately ask ourselves, is this kind of interpretation, this kind of, and the question mark behind this, is this gospel imposition into this book, is it really there? And the only way to judge that is to read the whole book. And then, and that applies to the Bible too, then as we interpret that particular passage, and if we find out through the whole book that this Holden Caulfield is a brainless, insensitive, stupid kid who just wants to bash the church, then our interpretation of that episode is wrong.
Not necessarily.
But, go ahead.
You know, the fact that I think, you know, youth can be all those things that you just mentioned. And the fact that he felt, you know, inside that he had to kind of blow the lid on the holiness stuff,
yeah,
to be perfectly true.
That's a good point. Because for sure, one of the truths that comes out of all good literature is the ambiguity and the equivocal voices of not just kids, but of everybody speaking. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I caught myself saying this more so a few years ago, but I've said it a lot in my life. Dear God, why don't I believe in you? I mean, that's ambiguous in itself. I'm addressing the person that I don't believe in. I said, what's helped me with my unbelief is that question, you know. So I'm just supporting your concept of ambiguity. Well, anybody else?
Well, you know, even the whole book, Caulfield in the whole book is a loser.
Yeah.
He isn't.
But he isn't.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, that's a good point.
So that the whole book is true to that little incident, I think. Isn't it?
Yep. Yep, I think that's a good point. Yes.
Well, he's an idealist, like many people are at that time of life, and he wants things to be perfect. And it occurs to me that by challenging these ideas we have, he's got a whole room full of people talking about it.
Him
and talking about their belief. And that's, aren't we put in that position as adults,
yes,
when our idealistic children talk to us The truth of the humanity and the truth that Jesus loves us because we're human, but he doesn't see that yet. But it helps us to relate to the
Good. Thank you. Anybody else? I'll take you on another journey. Anybody read Par Logarthus Barabbas? My wife has.
I have.
Bree has. As a signed reading to all friends, and so it's a signed reading. Barabbas is a fictionalized account of the Barabbas who was substituted for Jesus on the cross. And, Jesus was substituted for him. And Par Logarthus, the Swedish writer, imagines what it must have been like to be the one who was substituted, directly substituted. You know, we can say, Jesus died for your sins, Jesus died for you, and Barabbas is saying, whoa, that literally. And, well, the book is about this wonderful imaginative journey from doubt, from disbelief to doubt to faith, and it's a book about the nature of faith. And Barabbas has struggled throughout his life, and it's near ending now. He struggled throughout his life to try to get a hold of who this guy was. And early in the book it says, as he watches the crucifixion, he's out there against his will. He goes on his own will, but he says, I don't want to be here. It's full of contagion and disease, and he can't take his eyes off this whole crucifixion scene. He watches it till Jesus dies. So he's drawn to this guy just to, what kind of powers does he have? What's it like? And I hear stories that he might be God, and wow, that's really something. Well, he wants to believe in this guy as God because he wants to have some of those deep truths in his life be relevant to him and to have some connectedness to the meaning of life beyond plundering some church or some wagon that, he's a thief and a murderer and raping some woman, and that's kind of how he's been living all his life. And he wants more than that, because those things are the hey diddle diddles of his life, and it hasn't made for meaning in his life. Well, he meets a guy in a mine, and this guy is a believer, and he believes strongly in the you might argue that, if you read the book, we won't argue about it here, that this guy that he meets is pietistic and believes in what he's supposed to believe in, and that's all. He doesn't really have that wrestling kind of faith. But he has Jesus' name carved on his slave disc. On the front it says, I belong to Rome. On the back it's blank, and this guy draws Jesus, the fish, and Jesus, Christos Jesus, he writes on the disc, saying he belongs to Jesus. Well, that's against the law, okay? Barabbas says, carve that on my disc too. And the guy says, oh, gladly, Barabbas, I'll do it. And they're down in the mines. They've been down there for 30 years mining copper. And he carves Jesus' name on this disc. And eventually they get out of the mine and they get caught with this. Somebody turns them in and says, hey, these Roman slaves have Jesus' name on their disc. What's the deal? And that's where this scene begins to take, where it takes place. The Roman governor calls them in because it's pain of death to have this on your disc. He turned the metal disc over and looked with evident interest, but with no sign of surprise at the secret inscription on the back. Christos Jesus, he read, and both Sahak, that's his friend's name, Barabbas' friend's name, and Barabbas were filled with wonder that he could read the signs. He could decipher God's holy name. Who is that? He asked. It is my God, Sahak answered with a slight tremor in his voice. Aha! It is a name I cannot remember having heard before. But then there are so many gods, one can't keep track of them all. Is it the god of your native province? No. It is everybody's god. Everybody's, you don't say. That's not at all bad. And I have never even heard of him. He keeps his renown somewhat secret, if I may say so. Yes, said Sahak. Everybody's god. In that case, he must have more than a little power. What does he base it on? On love. Love? Well, why not? Anyway, it's no concern of mine. You may believe as you like about it. But tell me, why do you bear his name on your slave's disc? Because I belong to him, Sayhawk said again with a slight tremor. Indeed, belong to him. How can you do that? Do you not belong to the state? Just as this stamp signifies, are you not a state slave? Sayhawk made no reply. He merely stood looking down at the floor. At last the Roman governor said, but not at all unkindly, he must answer this. We must be quite clear on this point, don't you see? Do you belong to the state? Tell me now. I belong to the Lord my God, said Sayhawk without looking up. The governor stood regarding him. Then he lifted Sayhawk's head and looked into his burnt-up face, the face that had been at the smelting furnaces. He said nothing, and after a time, when he had seen what he wanted, he let go of the other man's chin. And then he went and stood in front of Barabbas, and as he turned over his slave's disc in the same way, he asked, And you? Do you also believe in this loving God? Barabbas made no reply. Tell me, do you? Barabbas shook his head. You don't? Well, why do you bear his name on your disc then? Barabbas was silent as before. Is he not your God? Isn't that what the inscription means? I have no God, Barabbas answered at last, so softly that it could hardly be heard. And Sayhawk and the Roman both heard it. And Sayhawk gave him a look so full of despair, pain, and amazement at his incredible words that Barabbas felt it pass right through him, right into his inmost being, even though he did not meet the other's eyes. The Roman, too, seemed surprised. But I don't understand, he said. Why then do you bear this Christos Jesus carved on your disc? Because I want to believe, Barabbas said without looking up at either of them. What do you make of that story, that episode? He's carved the name of Jesus on his disc at the risk of his life, but now when it comes down to it, Sayhawk, I have no other God. And he'll die. He's going to get crucified. And Barabbas says, I can't do that. I have no God. But I want to believe. Even without reading the book, we can step back and get some feelings. First, I suspect, and it's a great scene, isn't it? Is there an emotional tug at your heart in that? Sure. How does that scene apply to the human condition? I want to believe. How does that apply to us?
We do things every day that are that negate our belief, but still we want to believe.
Can you, and can anybody else, be concrete with ways that we negate our belief? How do we go about doing that? Yeah.
Well, you're with a group of friends and they're discussing religion and they, you know, are poo-pooing this and that, and you just keep your mouth shut.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think when you get in a crisis and you believe that God will bring light out of darkness, you believe that he loves you, and still you're scared to death as if you had no belief at all.
Yeah, you're hanging on the edge of the mountain and you'd really soon have a rope as a prayer. Yeah, give me a rope. Yeah, good.
Sometimes I get scared and I really believe that when I stay true to myself and true to God's message, I don't have to live in fear. But sometimes I get scared. I just get scared. I don't think that's hanging on to my belief.
In lots of cases. By the way, Barabbas is motivated by fear throughout this book, and his greatest fear is the fear of dying. And so he wants to believe in God, and that's going to deliver him from this death.
But again, without reading the book, but I think if I was the Roman, I would be more scared of Barabbas, because it seems to me that the desire to connect with God is really deeper and richer than kind of a static belief. It's that constant desire that desire for connection. And that can be scary to people.
Great point. What I've written here is the desire to connect is not the same as the certainty that we have already connected, or the absolutes. I told some of you, I've been to South Africa and I've listened to Afrikaners, and other people too, talk about the absoluteness of God's righteousness passed on to the white people of South Africa to justify apartheid. And they're certain that they have connected. We got the right connection. And all those black people, they don't have a connection. And that, and you're pointing out, and so does Lagerfist throughout this book, that this is a much more powerful and a faith-filled response than this is. The faith is full of, I want to connect, and it's full of uncertainty, it's full of mystery, it's full of doubt. And I'm not sure that I, and by the end of the book, by the way, Barabbas is the most faithful character in it. But never in the conventional ways, ever. Yes.
Well, Barabbas' response wasn't a whole lot different than the rich man asking how to enter the kingdom of God. He really wanted to believe. He really wanted to enter the kingdom of God. But if it meant selling all of his stuff, that's the true test. And yeah, that's kind of what Barabbas was up against. He didn't have a lot of wealth that he had to sell. But when it came right down to it.
Yeah. That's good. And then that's part of it. And this Sahak guy, he thought he is certainly that he had connected by doing what? I mean, I just got to write my name on this little disc here and I got it. Or I just got to go to church every Sunday and I got it. Or I just got to refrain from lusting after the such and such and I got it. All the stuff that is just willpower and control and ethical and moral. And boy, Lagerfist brings up, as we step back from this, that faith isn't manifest in our moral lives. Faith is manifest in our moral lives. Morality isn't a manifestation of faith. Or is it the other way around? Faith isn't a manifestation of morality. I guess that's it. The lights just go out back there. Yes?
I agree with what's been said. One thing I think is how easy it is to get overwhelmed with consumerism, and that becomes, you can have so much faith in material things that becomes your God rather than anything else. And then
yeah,
just going to
the
church,
disc.
You think that's your faith, too, what you said.
Yep. Good.
I think that we minimize faith sometimes when we see faith as a big act, a tremendously huge act that we have to come up with. When Jesus said, it's just a mustard seed, it's a tiny little thing.
Yeah.
And we think so much it has to be something we have, some big, huge thing, sacrifice, and it isn't.
Good. And have you read this book?
No.
Because it sounded like you almost had, because Barabbas keeps doing all these big acts, thinking, this will do it. And those big acts never do. It's something else. And it gets into Lutheran theology of grace and of faith as a gift. And And Lagerfist was a Lutheran, poor guy. No wonder he is so messed up. Anybody else? Here's our last one. This is a wonderful short story. I picked J.D. Salinger again. I have a colleague who I respect more than any other academician in my profession, who says this is the greatest short story in the 20th century. I agree with her. How am I going to disagree with her? Anyway. In this book, nine short stories by J.D. Salinger, there are two that are back-to-back, and one falls there. And the first one is called Down at the Dinghy. And Down at the Dinghy is a story, and these two are related, that's why I'm telling the story of the first one rather than read excerpts from it. Down at the Dinghy is a story of a little boy who's Jewish, and he has been told by, his mother finds out much later, he's been told by some friend that your daddy's a dirty kike. And so the kid runs away from home. He's three. He runs away from home and he sits down in this dinghy just tied to the dock at their property, and he won't come out. And his mother comes down there and says, what's wrong? And he won't talk. And he doesn't say a word, and she says, I'm the Admiral Neglass Tenenbaum. I've come here to check my stermophores. And this thing is a stermophore. She's talking all this sail talk. And eventually, by coming down to his level, she gets to kind of slip down into the boat and talk to him. And at one point, well, near the end of the story, the little kid is in her lap, and he says to her, "Why don't you go talk to Sandra?" Sandra's the maid up in the house. "Why don't you go talk to Sandra?" And she says, "I don't want to talk to Sandra. I want to talk to you. And besides, Sandra's too busy. And you're the most important thing in my life. I want to talk to you. Now, do you want to tell?" And he starts to cry. And then he says, "Sandra said, Daddy's a big sloppy kike." And she said, there's a wonderful line in there, typical Salinger, just flinching ever so imperceptibly. She's Jewish, too. Flinching ever so imperceptibly, she patted him on the butt and said, "That's not so bad, honey. That's not so bad. It's not the worst thing that could happen. I'll tell you what we'll do. We're going to go get some pickles," and he likes pickles. "And we're going to get Dad, and we're going to go for a ride in a boat. You want to go?" And he says yes, and that's the end of the story. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. But one of the things, if we read Salinger and step back, that's going on in this wonderful story is that this mother can save this boy. And she can save him by coming down to his level. If you were in an English class having this thing, some teacher would probably say, this mother is a Christ figure. Coming down to his level, saying, "You're the most important thing in the world. I don't want to talk to anybody else. I want to talk to you." And brings him out of his shell and saves his life. Well, in that story, now if you're out of context, you don't have to just read that story and say, isn't that nice? This mother loves this kid so much she can bring him out of his psychological depression and his fears. Well, there's another story. What's that?
7:15
o'clock
in this morning.
Oh, I was thinking of 7:15. Wow. I still have 5 minutes.
Yeah, I got 5 minutes.
And I'll take it. In Fresno, the Love and Squalor, it's the story of a soldier who goes crazy in the war. The war is so powerful to him and so evil to him that he can't cope with it. And I'll encourage you to read the story. It's in the library. This is it. I'll put it back. But it's also, I think, it's in the, it's 9 stories in the bookstore. Not yet. Okay.
Next week.
Okay. Esme, this little 13-year-old girl, meets this soldier and asks him to write a story for her. And he does. And he tells the story of his own insanity in the war. And she sends him her father's wristwatch in the mail. Now, they have met for 20 minutes in the cafeteria. He's 22, she's 13, there's no relationship at all, there's nothing between the two of them in this 20-minute talk in the cafeteria, in the cafe, except she sends this watch that belonged to her father who was killed in the war. In his insanity, he opens the package for therapy. He has to burn the string off because his fingers are shaking so much. And he sees the watch, and the story ends, "You take a sleepy man, Esme, and he always stands a chance of returning from the war with his faculties intact." And his insanity is lifted. I want to suggest to you the gospel in that. It's not one person's love like it was in Dante Dini. The mother saved the child. It's not Esme's love for the sergeant, his name is Sergeant X, that saves him. It's the agape love that exists that's bigger than any single person can ever be manifestation of. And that love exists in this world that he has seen full of chaos and war and evil, saves his life. The gospel is there. The power of love to make light out of darkness, to make order out of chaos, and then what Jesus says over and over again, love can transfigure anything. You gotta run. Thank you. Thank you.